Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, CEO and founder of Finstrat Management. With us today, we've got Nathan Rosenberg. Nathan is the founder and CEO of PharmBlocks. Nathan, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So PharmBlocks, let's start with brass tacks. What problem is it solving in the market?
We're solving the problem of labor in agriculture, which is, if people don't know, it's one of the biggest problems facing our food supply system. You know, we have half the number of farmers that we need in the United States alone to farm the food we eat every day. And so we're solving that through automation. So basically what we're doing is we're building the building blocks of automation for agriculture. So a farmer can sort of mix and match these building blocks to create a system that works for their farm. So if you want to automate watering, you can do that. If you wanted to automate, you know, checking if a pipe is broken, you can do that. So things that farmers do every day, we're working to help automate that.
Root cause, what do we, is there a general accepted opinions as to what's at the root for lack of farmers in the U.S.?
Well, there's a few things. One, it's very hard.
Okay.
And so, you know, people these days want to be able to press a button, have something happen, which is impossible to do in agriculture. You know, the average age of a farmer in the United States is 60 years old, which is, you know, about 5 years away from retirement if you're a normal person. So, it's just hard work. And the newest generation, for the most part, doesn't want to do that sort of hard work anymore.
Interesting. And so if we were to do a breakdown of all of the farmland in the U.S., what percentage of it is corporations versus independent farmers?
Yeah. So of the land, about a third is big corporate farms. Of the number of farms, it's about 10%. So 90% of all farms are still family owned, you know, small, medium size, as they call them. And, you know, most of the number of farmers are, you know, family generational farmers. So, yeah, there's still a number of them out there.
Well, it's fantastic to hear. Arguably part of the bedrock of the country, not only just because we need to eat, but I'm sure we can devote an entire episode on independent farmers versus big corporations.
Yeah. But
instead of going down that road, okay, so just continuing to unpack, I have in my head that margins on farming are generally thin. And so I imagine that, I don't imagine anything. You might have run into headwinds or currently run into headwinds when getting farmers to adopt technology. What's your experience been like?
Yeah, so it really depends on what you're growing. So if you're growing, you know, what are called row crops, so corn, wheat, soy, you know, the things that you see in the Midwest, those are generally very low margin. That's why your average farm is like 1,000 to 10,000 acres. That's sort of where it actually makes sense to grow that. If there weren't government subsidies, it just wouldn't make sense to grow those crops. And so we're more focused on crops that are not automated. So all of those big row crops, you know, John Deere and a lot of the other big companies in agriculture, they've put a lot of money and time over the last 100 years to automate that. And so you can drive a combine to harvest. You can, set up irrigation. There's varietals of corn that will just grow anywhere. And so we're more focused on what are called permanent specialty crops. So things that you actually eat every day, things that you don't harvest and like pull up out of the ground. So think of like orchards, vineyards, maple syrup is a big one that we're targeting. And so with those, you know, it's very manual in terms of like harvesting. Vineyards, a lot of them are still harvested by hand. Orchards, you know, it's a lot of manual work to turn on water, to spray chemicals and whatnot. So
Got it. And I'd love to know what was the genesis behind helping farmers?
yeah, so it's been a long journey, as you can probably imagine. It sort of stems all the way back to when I was in high school and worked on a farm up the street. I went to school for robotics in Massachusetts with the goal of sort of automating all of agriculture. And so, in senior year, I met my co-founders and we started what turned into FarmBlocks, which was we were trying to grow plants on shelves inside of 40-foot shipping containers with robots, doing all the work. We were trying to automate everything, right? And so, as it turns out, if you have to pay for the sun, that's not a great model, business model, and the economics of that really don't work out when you're
Interesting.
competing with farms that don't have to do that. So, in that process, we learned a lot about agriculture and what sort of the everyday struggles are of the farmer. And we took a lot of the technology, the sensing technology we developed in doing that, and packaged it to basically help automate existing farms. And one thing led to another. We found maple syrup as a sort of our beachhead market. And we helped them find leaks in their sap collection tubes, something that takes them like 18 hours a day, every day during the season to find. And we help automate that. Now we're out in California, which just moved the company out here, and helping, big orchards find copper theft. That's sort of our next sort of tip of the spear. Way to get into that market. So it's a big problem. And we try to target this big labor, big, hair on fire problems. And then, there's a bunch of other stuff we can do on top of that. But those are what we focus on.
Got it. And so, if we can unpack the solution itself, sounds like it's a combination of both software and hardware.
That's right. Yeah. So you can think of it as a very modular IoT platform. And so we built what we call a universal monitor box, where all it is a box with a battery and some software on it, where you can plug in any sensor we support, mix and match sensors, controllers, and tap your phone to it, and it shows up in our app. And so then you can put that on any part of your farm that you want. And you could mix and match, think of like Legos, but for automation and IoT.
Wow. Okay. And how many years in have you been building farm blocks?
Of almost 3 years now. So we bootstrapped to the first like 50 customers or so. We closed our first investment round last year. So it's been about a year and a half since we got VC backed.
Congrats.
And yeah, it's been, pants on fire, strapped to a rocket ship ever since.
I think it's par for the course for founders.
That's right.
So the decision to bootstrap, do you feel like was that intentional? Or did you find that a lot of investors were telling you that, hey, before we're gonna cut a check, that we want to see that you actually got some traction?
Yeah, so it was intentional. But it was intentional given feedback from investors we talked to early on. We did have a few angels who were very gracious and sort of believed in the vision, what we were doing. But agriculture is traditionally a very hard market to sell into, and especially new technology. And so, in order to prove that our solution is something that sort of is solving a dying, hair on fire problem for farmers, and they were willing to pay for it and have the sort of short sales cycles that VC looks for, we had to bootstrap and use angel money to get to that point.
And so these first 50 clients, and from a sales and marketing perspective, did you target farmers that were close to home,
We
Massachusetts?
did. We
Yeah.
did, yeah. So we started the company in Massachusetts in the Boston area. Maple syrup was our first market, obviously. Vermont and maybe close to us, great market. They're already fairly tech adverse, or tech accepting rather, and we were solving a very pointed problem. And so that was a great first market, and we could drive to our customers. If there was a problem, they could call us, and we'd be there. So it worked out pretty
Fantastic.
well.
And so recently we were talking offline that you made the decision to travel across the coast of California.
It
Presume part of that was strategic.
very we wouldn't have done that if it wasn't. So yeah, a lot of our newer, larger customers are based here in California. And that's sort of the future of the company is big California specialty crop agriculture. You know, California is sort of the center of that in the world. You know, a lot of it's moving to South America and, you know, parts of Europe, but the California is where the home base is for that. Also, all of technology is based here as well. So it was a natural fit, and this was the time to do it.
Fantastic. So, you know, working with investors or founders and investors ourselves, you know, we generally run down KPI metrics, obviously big focus on return on customer acquisition costs and know what our ROI is. But I'm curious, you know, as you're selling into agriculture, did you find that you had to, you know, do a really succinct and clear job of helping farmers understand what the return on investment was going to be? And if so, you know, did you ever find that it was nebulous, or did you figure out how to crack that nut to make it clear to farmers that no, you know, employing our sensors will actually either, you know, generate top line or improve your margins?
So that's why we focus on very specific problems on the farm. It's problems where in your head you can actually calculate the ROI of deploying a sensor solution. So that's why we started with leeks in maple tubes in maple, because they know that they spend 18 hours a day, dozens of people finding those leeks. So they can visualize, hey, I'm going to spend like a quarter of my time that I used to finding those leaks. You know, it's the same in California with theft. It's, hey, every time this happens, you know, it's a 40% chance every year that this happens. You know, it's a $50,000 damage every time it does happen. And so it's like, oh, hey, yeah, that makes sense. Let's do that. And so those are the problems we try to enter with. And then, you know, there's more that crop up that are less hair on fire, but that they can expand with.
And so 3 years ago, when you started the company, was it intuitive for you to know that's the starting point? Or did you find that you had to have a lot of dialogue with your client, the farmers, you know, in order to hone in on where their pain points were?
Yeah, so we did know one thing. We knew that we didn't know. And we also knew that no two farms are alike. And so if you develop a product that's solves one problem in a very specific way, then that you're gonna like be able to hit like 10% of all farms, maybe. And so we were like, hey, we don't actually know what we're doing for a reason. And so let's develop a product that's designed for that specific issue. And so, you know, the whole modular, very flexible system. And so technically we were a solution and solve of a, or in search of a problem, but that was by design, if
And
that makes sense.
how much do you think was, or you attribute to just perseverance until you hit the point where you realize that you're on the right track versus just iterating until you found something that stuck?
Yeah, so it's a lot of experiments. So we developed the platform so we could easily and cheaply do a lot of experiments. And so, you know, early on we were testing with, you know, organic vegetable farms, we were testing with dairy farms and a bunch of others that are in the Northeast. And, you know, the one that stuck very clearly was maple syrup and finding leaks in their collection tubes. And you know, I think that only took like 6 months to find that, and then we were all in on that problem, and then expanding in that market. It took us about the same amount of time here in California to find that theft was like the biggest problem. And actually, our customers came to us with this problem, and it actually affected us on one of our tests where, you know, we just put a like everything plus the kitchen sink in to see what really helped with their operation. And then one day everything went down and we realized someone stole copper that powered our base station that connects everything to our app. And we called the farmer, like they were like, yeah, you know, this happens all the time. Someone stole a copper. We'll be back on in a few weeks here when we can fix it. But like, oh, huh, I wonder if this happens to other people. And so
Interesting.
we went down that path.
Serendipitous. So with that, sensors, I find myself in conversations and I find that founders are intimidated by the thought of hardware. What was your experience like?
So hardware is was hard. Whoever named hardware is
That
a wise person.
experience.
Software is easy. You can iterate very quickly. You can, deploy it anywhere. It's one of the best business models ever. Hardware is great for another reason, because it's so hard. You have more time until someone catches up. And with us, it's very sticky, because if you put something physical out in your fields, there's very little of an incentive to switch once you do that. So I think it's actually an advantage for us, and because of the way we designed it, we got to economies of scale pretty quickly. And so but I don't recommend doing hardware unless it's really good for your business.
That's interesting. So were you building your own prototypes, or did you go find a third party to help create?
So for the most part, it's all our own hardware. So up until like our 5,000th device sold, we were actually assembling it ourselves as well. So I don't know if I'd recommend that, but for us, it was a sort of a strategic advantage.
Well, I have to ask,
So.
you reflect back on all the iterations. What would you share with another founder who insists on pursuing it because they agree with you that hardware could potentially create a moat?
Try as much as possible to find off-the-shelf things that you can build and test with. I wouldn't recommend building your own hardware until you can test your market and make sure that you're actually solving a problem that someone will actually pay for. So we did that. It was very janky, let's just say.
Sure.
But it worked, and we were able to test and get a lot of feedback. And then, within a few months, we were able to make our own hardware and get that out in the hands of customers. But yeah, it's hard. It takes a lot of money.
Well, I'm curious. I want to take advantage of the fact that what I heard was, hey, don't necessarily build it and think that they'll come.
Yeah.
So let's, if we can shine a bright light on that, a lot of founders think along those lines. As you reflect back, why do you think you were in that camp, that the field of dreams is going to work?
Yeah. We knew that there were problems that we could solve that were hair on fire problems. And we didn't know specifically which ones were ones that farmers would actually want to solve with technology. And so that's why we developed our product the way we did, where if we wanted to do another experiment with a customer, it would only take us a few hours to modify our product to fit that need. So like integrate a new sensor or controller, or bring up a different type of dashboard on the app. And so we knew that from the beginning, and that's what we designed a product around. But if you're doing a verticalized solution in a specific problem, and you're building your entire platform to solve that one problem, you need to find a way to do it as cheaply as possible and as fast as possible so you can iterate.
Yeah, it does seem like speed is the biggest component, and I imagine hardware by definition is low speed.
Yeah,
So totally
it
makes sense
is.
that
It
off
is.
the shelf makes a difference.
It does. Yeah, it's hardware is very low speed. And even with us, who we try to use all the modern techniques, 3D printing and rapid manufacturing of circuit boards and stuff like that, it's still, your cycles are weeks, not hours or minutes. And so Iteration takes a while, and especially if you need to put the thing out on a farm field and wait for Mother Nature to have its way with the device and figure out, hey, this actually, there's a pinpoint hole somewhere. You don't know where, and only affects 1% of these. And so I just think of it as a moat.
Interesting. 3D printing. I think you may have the distinction of being the first guest on the podcast who's using the technology. What's your experience been like?
Yes, I actually have an interesting experience with 3D printing. So before I started Farmblox, I worked for a few years at a company that was doing metal 3D printing, sort of
No.
pushing the envelope of that. They obviously did normal 3D printing like with plastic. But to this day, we still send 3D printed parts to our customers. So we have these brackets that go on our monitor box that actually allow bungee cords to attach them to trees for maple. And so, it still makes sense for us to do that, but it lets us test new fixtures and it actually helps in the manufacturing process too, where you can have jigs to help with speed up things. So I recommend it. It's fun. It's very low cost and it's very reliable these days.
Any 3D printing manufacturer in particular that you find yourself gravitating towards?
Well, everyone in the industry is moving to bamboo. And so we did the same. Bamboo Labs, they're cheap, they're really fast, very, very repeatable. So two parts done at two different times will look the exact same. And everyone's sort of struggling to catch up with them at this point.
Great intel, thank you. Continuing on with product market or product development, what I'm curious. So, when you're in budget mode, how are you thinking about growth right now? Do you find that your focus is on optimizing the product or sales and marketing?
So for the first year after we were VC backed, it was a lot of focus on product. Let's get this scalable. Let's get this ready for prime time. And so we're at that point now, and we actually just brought on our first VP of sales. She's based here in California. She's had, over a decade of experience in ag tech in California. So now I think we're ready, the product's ready to go, big. And so that's our in the last few months, that's been our refocus.
Fantastic. And up until this point, have you has been founder-led sales? Have you been leading the effort?
Yeah, so myself and my co-founder Mark, we've been leading sales for mostly Mark actually since the beginning, and now it's our VP of sales.
So
So
even in the setting of having someone over the sales org, do you anticipate that Mark and to the degree that you get involved will continue to?
oh yeah, we're part of the sales team. It's just, we have other focuses too. And so having a dedicated sales leader has been really awesome. And the day I stop talking to customers is the day I think it's time to, to move on. So, it's how do you make a decision as a founder or a CEO without talking to your customers? That's crazy.
I agree 100%. It was funny. We're in the process of updating the testimonials on our website, and one of our clients shared with our chief revenue officer something to that effect. It's like, oh, yeah, and I actually get to talk to your CEO, and so Adam Chen, our chief revenue officer, shared that with me, and I was same response as you. It's like I can't imagine. Way. I don't know that I get any credit for that. Yeah, any founders listening, I mean, I think it's par for the course. So good on you. Got it. Okay, so VCs, you mentioned you raised around. What was your experience like?
It's so it was good. We were lucked out and were able to get a very good founder friendly VC based in Boston when we were based in Boston, and working with them has been amazing. They led our last round. And we were able to bring on a number of other really great investors. And so we fortunately haven't had the experience of working with a bad investor, but I can definitely see it being detrimental to your company.
Sure.
But we are very aligned with our investors, and whenever we have a win, I let them know, and they get all excited, and so we're really truly building the company together.
Great. So I don't know whose count to go off of, but depending on who you listen to, there's thousands of VCs in the US. And they also seek to differentiate themselves. And their platform is could be key to that, or it could just be advice or capital. What were the things that were most important to Mark and you when you were starting this process and before you accepted somebody's check?
So something I've learned is investors who really emphasize meeting in person, and instead of giving news over an email, give it over a phone call. That's a green flag. And it was pretty apparent when we were raising our first round that that was something to look out for. And so we made sure to do that and emphasize that with our investors. I don't know if that's what you're looking for, but I think that's something I've been using.
Yeah, when I think that's brilliant. What I hear is relationship. I probably like a lot of the world, developed worlds. I mean, the convenience of Zoom is amazing. But yeah, no substitute for being face to face with colleagues and peers. And I mean, 100%. I mean, I work from home, and last night, this will probably get published maybe late October, but last night, this early October 2025. Now, but last night, we were at an Alchemist Accelerator event in the Bay Area, and it's brilliant, spending FaceTime with people and just getting to know someone beyond the time you get in a Zoom. So totally makes sense. And so to that end, what's been the degree that you've relied on them since you closed the round, if at all?
So going into fundraising, I never wanted, I didn't think I wanted investors who were, involved and wanted to help. It was just, I wanted money and then we'll build a company. And as it turns out, it's very helpful, especially when you're fundraising again. Intros, really warm intros, advice on the pitch. They've especially operators turned investors very helpful because they've seen a thing or two across their own experience and then companies in their portfolio. So just running by, sort of high level ideas, that's been awesome too. So no, it's use your investors. They're there to help you. So
That's great. I've also participated in conversations of, do either founder investors or operator investors have an advantage over just traditional investors?
I think so, especially early stage, because you obviously haven't been in their shoes before, but I would imagine that seeing trends that you've experienced yourself before, you're like, hey, oh, I get what they're doing there and why they're doing it. Even if it looks weird to most people, I think that's a very strategic advantage, especially when evaluating companies in the pipeline. And that gives you a strategic advantage in hopefully getting that investment because, founders like working with founders. Let's be honest.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's for those of the members of the audience who aren't as familiar with venture, there's a, I don't know, heuristic or formula is the right word, but it's source, pick, win, add value, monetize. And if you think about Yes, there are a lot of founders out there who will happy to accept anybody's capital. That isn't always the case. And so, you know, investors, and depending on the deal, have a responsibility to, you know, hey, let's date. These are my attributes and why I think you should pick me. So totally, totally makes sense. And yeah, it'd be interesting to see how venture continues to evolve in this country. You know, not the most forgiving of fundraising environments right now. Arguably, you can say that there's going to be a shakeout if we're already seeing it with smaller VCs. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it definitely makes the case for anyone who's thinking about pursuing venture as a career that, hey, you know, even if your background is being a founder and operator, it actually puts you in a great position.
I think so. Yeah, definitely.
Good stuff. So, artificial intelligence. What's the degree that you're using it in the? And I didn't think I was going to ask you that. What's the degree that you're using it in your software stack right now?
Yeah. So that's basically our whole vision for the product. Is sort of phase one is getting devices on farms, providing early value, capturing data, you know, sort of being locked into capturing data across their entire, you know, the entire operation. So like harvest all the way back to, you know, planting of the plant, how much water that was delivered, what was the weather like? And so the idea is, you know, capture value now with, you know, very understandable, you know, value propositions, and then bring on AI as tools. So, you know, one of the first things we did with AI was find leaks, intelligently find leaks in irrigation. And the only way you can do that was with AI and lots of data. But to the farmer, we don't advertise it as AI. It's just another tool to help save labor. And so that's our whole strategy around AI. You know, we're using AI internally to help code. Like, we have a front end development team of one person, and he's like 30 people, and so that's with the help of AI. So we're all for it, but peacefully.
So a little bit in the weeds, but I'd be curious to know. I'm far from an AI expert, but I've been educating myself. I've been participating in conversations around large versus small language models. Obviously, the compute cost being one of the big differences, but also just, hey, what you're trying to solve. What's the conversation been like inside farm blocks? Not only from, hey, what type of model do we want to use, but also are you running it at the sensor level, or is it being fed to the cloud and you're running it in the back end?
Yeah, so we don't actually use large language models today in our product. So this is more traditional machine learning, you know, from proprietary data, like time series data. But we do have the goal of including large language models, probably with an API, if I was to guess. We don't want to run them ourselves. We don't have sensitive data like that, where, you know, a farmer can type in with or speak into their phone, hey, this is what I want to do. I want to turn on the irrigation, you know, when my well has a lot of water and my soil is dry and like it's not raining. And then it will pop out with an automation to do that. So they don't have to touch anything technology. It just sort of happens.
No. And what does the roadmap look like to bring that to production?
Yeah. So we're hoping in the next year that that's going to be a reality. You know, it's, we have all the sort of the building blocks to be able to do that right now. So that's our short, medium term goal, let's just say.
I love it. I'm curious, what are the, or I don't know, headwinds is the right word, but as you think about planning, what are the big things that have your attention as you look to incorporate that into the product?
Yeah. Yeah, headwinds. I mean, for us, you know, there's, you know, the increasing labor shortage, you know, everything around that, that's been a tailwind. So it's been pushing us in certain directions. If we go to raise another round, sort of what are the sort of the keywords people are looking for? I mean, we don't do that for the most part. We're just put AI in our deck just because. Yeah, there's just a number of trends. We're trying to be in the right place at the right time, especially around labor and agriculture.
Great, love it. Well, I think we may need to have you back on the show a year from now to hear how it played out.
Yeah.
My sense is talking to founders is that we know the top technology is here. It's starting to mature. There's absolutely opportunities here to bring some value add features and functions, but there's still some hurdles to figure out in terms of cost to compute. Where you're running it, are you on a local device? And in which case, it has to be a small language model. Someone figure out, a better way to compute large pieces of data. So it's super exciting stuff. I see we're near the end of the podcast. Really appreciate your time. Before we wrap up, Nathan, just a retrospective. As you look back, what key pieces of advice or wisdom would you share either with your younger self or anyone who's listening as to, like, hey, this is what I learned, and consider this as you look to build your company.
I was mentoring another entrepreneur yesterday, and they're trying to figure out their pitch. And one of the things that I remember that really transformed our pitch when fundraising was go deep on your personal story, like way deeper than you think you need to. It's not just your resume, it's like you as a person, especially for early stage. And so, like, go back to like where you were born, where you were raised. Did you have any struggles growing up? Where'd you, what'd you have on your 10th birthday for your birthday dinner? Like that sort of thing. And spend a long time talking about that, especially long-term pitch, long-form pitch. So, I wish I did that earlier on. I think I would have probably had an easier time fundraising early. Because made the mistake of being a little bit too humble when talking about that and just glazing over that and just talking about the product and the business. So yeah, that's probably a piece of advice I'd give to anybody.
I think it makes good sense. If you think, especially early stage, founding team is key variable to the formula. And I think it depends who you ask, but general consensus is that the experience that has got us at this point absolutely does make a difference. Because being a founder is hard and it requires grit and resilience. And if that comes out of the story, totally makes sense.
Yeah, that was actually a piece of advice given to me by one of our VCs, and it was given to him by one of his LPs. And I know it transformed his fundraising experience for his fund. And so, yeah, just you're investing the people for the most part.
Love it. Last question before we wrap up. Love to use this platform to give an opportunity to give a shout out to anyone personally or professionally who's had a meaningful impact on you over the years. You're welcome to do so.
Yeah, honestly, I mean, there's just so many people. But my co-founder Mark, he's always, we've been working together for almost 10 years now, and it's, we have had our ups and downs, but it's, I couldn't imagine starting a company without him. So, yeah, just Mark Prince.
All right, Mark. Well, that's fantastic. Shout out to Mark. And before we wrap up, if there's anyone who's listening who would love to learn more about Farmblocks, connect with you, how can they find you?
Yeah, either LinkedIn, just search for my name, or farmblocks.ag, farmblocks with an X.
Fantastic. Love it. Nathan, Really appreciate your time. And again, for the benefit of our audience, Nathan Rosenberg, founder and CEO of FarmBlocks. Again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez. Thank you for joining us for another episode on the Innovators Investors Podcast.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com/podcast-guest. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.